The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. This is our monthly episode 4, where we get to ask our speaker all the questions that we've gotten from our episodes for the month so far. And by the way, thanks for all your questions and feedback. Welcome back to the Q&A session of Virtual Curbside for this month. We're very fortunate to have Dr. Christy Kleinschmidt back with us. And, you know, there's always a lot of interest in mental health topics, Christy, and I think that's reflected in the questions that we have this month. Are you ready for hard questions?
I am ready for hard questions. And I also want to say I still have nothing to disclose. No conflicts of interest.
it's well known to people close to the podcast that I have a really hard time remembering that. And part of that, A, is that I have no conflicts and don't know what they are. But the other part of it is I just assume the best of everyone. How's that?
I think that's a really good thing to tell yourself, Paul.
So as a psychiatrist, what does that say about me? That Well, let's get started right away. Let's start with a fairly difficult question from Josh Maxwell here in Salt Lake City, Southwest Children's Clinic. If I have a patient that I've started treating for depression, trigger a manic episode, and re-diagnose with bipolar disorder or bipolar depression, what's the best way to continue treatment? Continue SSRI and add an antipsychotic? Or if a family is resistant to adding a new medication, can I continue with the SSRI alone?
Yeah, so if you truly triggered a manic episode with your SSRI, you should probably just continue it. And because the chance of them continuing to have manic episodes or an unstable mood is pretty high with just an SSRI alone. So in that situation, your best course of action would be to start some sort of a mood stabilizing medication, which would be a whole nother podcast that we could talk about, right? You know, there is a few that are approved for bipolar in children for acute episodes and then ongoing sort of depression treatment or adjunctive treatment. But I do think, you know, phoning your friend at the call-up line would be a really good way to start for that too, which would be 801-587-3636. And the psychiatrist could help guide you through those options. You know, initially we typically would do something like probably aripiprazole if really you're sort of stuck and that's kind of where you want to go because it's FDA approved, but it's not really the scope of this podcast probably to get in completely to what we do with bipolar. But yeah, I would stop the SSRI and you really want to see the mood get stabilized so it's not getting into like a mixed or manic place before you would want to add an SSRI in again.
And just to be perfectly clear, let's say that I triggered this manic episode with fluoxetine, then I should avoid all the SSRIs.
Yeah, you know.
Being thoughtful.
Yeah, no, I am. It's really hard, right? Because sometimes kids will get activated on SSRIs and, you know, or maybe it's even a bit of a hypomanic episode. You know, if it doesn't get so bad that they get hospitalized or, you know, are doing really dangerous things and it's maybe more along the line of like hypomania or activation, you could try really well supervised another low dose of a different SSRI and go very slowly with, you know, good, you know, anticipatory guidance to the parents and just see, like maybe that was kind of a fluke reaction to that one SSRI. If they're like having a full-blown manic episode, not sleeping, you know, spending all their savings, doing really risky things that are atypical for them, I would be really hesitant to put a different SSRI for that kiddo. You know, you could consider like bupropion in that situation if the family was really hesitant for a mood stabilizer and depression was continuing to be the most presenting sign. But again, if they got manic, the bupropion is not going to help the mania at all. So,
and again, my impression of bipolar disorder is that there is no shame in phone a friend if you truly encounter bipolar disorder. Am I oversimplifying there?
No. Please phone a friend and probably refer to psychiatry, I would say. I think the AAP certainly doesn't expect pediatricians to be treating bipolar. I think you can recognize it, right? And know when to refer. But gosh, I haven't had a ton of kids over the course of my career that truly have bipolar disorder in their, you know, adolescence. And so it is a perfectly reasonable referral to psychiatry.
And if there were only a simple way to reach a pediatrician 5 days a week, every afternoon. Oh, wait, there is.
And there is.
You mentioned the call-up line.
I did. So it's a legislatively funded psychiatric access consultation line, which means we have psychiatrists sitting by the phone every afternoon. Please call us 801-587-3636. You can also go to www.uofuhealth.org/call-up and submit a consult online. So
you're really good at that.
We need people to use us. We really do. So you can, yeah.
It's such a wonderful program. And it's something that I think that the only, if it's being underutilized, it's because it's underrecognized. Ready for another question?
I am.
This comes from BJ Kramer, a new pediatrician in the area. His first question, because he has a couple. Number one, what role does genetic or DNA testing for antidepressant medication have in treating depression or anxiety? Do you ever order the test? How do you order it? Is it helpful? I had a parent ask me about it, and I wasn't sure how to answer.
Yeah, you know, that's a really timely question. So the short answer is it's not really helpful in treating depression. So there's a company, I don't really want to promote them. So there's like a private company that does these, you know, genetic DNA tests. You can also order them through our local lab here. It's a cytochrome P450 genotype panel. And really the goal of these genetic tests are to look for mutations in how your body metabolizes these medications. So, you know, the unfortunate thing is, especially the private genetic company comes back with this really pretty printout of like these green medicines and yellow medicines and red medicines. And I think most people think, oh, green means good. That's what I should use to treat the depression. But really green just means that's what your body metabolizes as the drug maker assumes your body is going to metabolize it. And so it doesn't tell you at all which medicine should be effective. If that makes sense. It's sort of this nuanced thing, but it shouldn't help guide which medicine to choose that you think would be the most effective.
Is it useful at all for knowing whether you may have to adjust the dose?
Yeah. So if I've had somebody who just doesn't respond to medicines like I think they should, or they've had just some, you know, unexpected side effects that I haven't seen before, or just, you know, we've tried two or three different medicines and it just doesn't seem like it's going in the right direction, I will then order the test occasionally just to get an idea of what their metabolic picture looks like, just you know, to guide then my like fourth or fifth choice of medicine, right? But I've never, you know, I've never used it in the first place to see what would be the best medicine to choose.
Because even then, it doesn't necessarily predict how someone's likely to respond to a medication, right?
Totally,
metabolism.
Right. And I mean, most of us, I mean, I don't know that I metabolize medicines fine, but I mean, I could metabolize them perfectly fine. And they're still not the most effective medicine for my depression. Right. Yeah.
Very helpful. Ready for another question?
Yep.
Here you go. Do you have any self-help books that are good to recommend for parents and adolescents to deal with their depression?
Yeah. So I have a few that I like to recommend. So for parents, I've had multiple adults actually tell me that they have really enjoyed The Happiness Trap, which is a bestseller. And there's a workbook that goes along with the book itself. I have no association with any of the books I'm going to talk about. They just, I think, reinforce concepts that I really appreciate. And so The Happiness Trap takes its guidance from a type of therapy called acceptance and commitment therapy, which can be a really useful therapy for managing and sort of getting on with life while you have depression. For teenagers, I like a lot of the books that have like cognitive behavioral therapy or dialectical behavioral therapy principles. And so there's one called Mind Over Mood that comes from CBT. Don't Let Your Emotions Ruin Your Life. That one is more DBT. It's more about like managing your moodiness that you might have. Beyond the Blues is also a good one for depression. And then there's quite a few, if you go to, you know, any online bookseller you'd like to go to, you can find there's a lot of like adolescence workbook for, and there's a whole series of different workbooks that really do take their principles from CBT that I think could be effective.
And these work pretty well unsupervised by a therapist?
you know, I mean, they're better than nothing for sure. I do think, you know, it might be useful for parents to go through them with the kids and at least sort of, you know, reinforce some of the concepts that are coming out while they're doing them. There's not a lot of research about self-help books. I think there was maybe not a great powered study that, I mean, it certainly was better than nothing. And some kids who certainly have like milder impairment may do just, and who are kind of studious, right? Like they may do just fine with going through these workbooks themselves.
Right, right.
Yeah.
The last question we have is a fairly long one, but I think it's one that almost everyone asks at some point or another. I wanted to ask a clarifying question about discontinuing antidepressants. If I remember correctly, you mentioned that often you would treat for 6 to 12 months and then consider discontinuing the medication. What kind of discussion do you have with people when just starting a medication, or for those who have been on these medications for years and are doing well? I often struggle with how to have that conversation, addressing parents and patients' concern with what will happen if I stop, or why risk the relapse by stopping if things are going well? How much should I try to encourage families and patients to try discontinuing the medication, especially if often life seems to get harder as kids get older?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's interesting because that's kind of the opposite take that I typically have when I'm talking with kids about starting medications. You know, they think 6 to 12 months sounds like an eternity. but typically when I first start a medication, I will have a conversation with the kids and the family, you know, about we're going to start this medicine. We're going to keep moving the dose up until we get you to a point that your depression's feeling better. Recommendation at that point is to keep you on that dose for 6 to 12 months. So let's count on maybe you being on this dose for this entire school year or all the way through next summer. I try to put it in some perspective. And then we'll see how you're doing. And if you're doing okay, we could maybe try to start, you know, lowering your dose. And then if we lower your dose a bit and your symptoms come back, then we can just go back to your regular dose. And maybe we try again at a later time to see if your body's ready at that point to come off the medications. If you've had more than one episode of depression, I mean, I think in adults, it's typically like 3 or more episodes, you know, the recommendations for adults is that you just sort of stay on treatment for kind of indefinitely. And there's not a great rule for kids for that, but it's certainly something that I would consider as well. So, you know, with the hesitancy, I think just some reassurance, we're not going to just stop your medicine. We're going to go down really slowly. We're going to pick a time where it's maybe the least stressful, even though that's a great point. Life just keeps getting stressful, but we'll go slowly. And if you start to feel like you're getting worse, we just go back to a previous dose and we have this discussion again at a later time. The thought is that the SSRIs with some, you know, behavior change and sort of therapy changes and change in how you think about things restructures how your brain utilizes serotonin. And so at some point, hopefully your body doesn't need the SSRI to be doing that anymore. Right. So, I mean, I think kind of talking to families about that a little bit too.
Do you ever take issues like seasonality into account in stopping a medication? Are you more likely to stop in the summer or less likely to stop in the summer, for instance?
No, I will often sort of target the end of the school year to kind of taper people off if I want to, right? I'll pick the least stressful time. You know, if I have someone that I know is going to be going off to college this fall, I'm probably not going to do anything about it. I'm going to let them get through their first year of college or maybe check in with them after, you know, their finals for their first semester and see how things went. And so I definitely do. I think there's, you know, even if they don't need the medicine anymore, I really wouldn't want to have this sort of, I mean, I don't even know that there's a technical word for this, but a placebo effect in the opposite direction of just sort of like giving them some uncertainty in their ability to manage mm-hmm. the stressors that are coming. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's certainly nothing I would force the issue on, right? And it's probably something I would just continue to bring up, you know, if families or kids are really resistant to getting off of them, I think I would just sort of say, okay, it sounds like, you know, we're not ready to do this yet. That's fine. You know, let's talk about this again in 3 months because, you know, your depression's been better now for 12 months. And so the recommendation would be to get off, but, you know, let's just talk about it again next time you come. And I think I would just not force the issue necessarily.
Often kids and parents aren't on the same page about this. How do you deal with that?
Yeah. I mean, I think I typically side with whoever I agree with.
But
But no, I mean, I think trying to acknowledge both people's perspectives and also highlighting what, you know, the limited science that we know tells us and trying to make some sort of compromise for where we go, right? It's a lot of kind of negotiations, unless there's like a clear right answer, like, oh no, you've been on this medicine 6 weeks and you, you know, told me you had suicidal thoughts 2 weeks ago. I don't think it's time to come off this medicine yet, right?
And I do think this is one area where there's a real advantage to having mood disorders treated in your primary care office. And that's that there's a natural tendency to be able to say, look, let's talk again in 3 months about how you're doing. Let's talk about everything that's going on and try to put it in a context. It feels natural for us, I think, to say, yeah, let's talk again at the end of the summer, or let's talk when it's likely to be stressful for you and see how you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also think, you know, this is a good opportunity to do your screeners, right? To keep your PHQAs or PHQ9s, whatever you decide, you know, kind of have a string of those. And so you can actually look back and say, well, look, I mean, you're, gosh, the last 18 months of these we have, you aren't even at the level of depression. You know, I wonder if we want to consider maybe coming off of these medicines at this point. And, you know, like, people have stressors, and people who don't have a diagnosis of depression sometimes get sad or get stressed out with life changes. And so what did you learn in therapy? How did you learn to cope ahead with things? What, you know, what supports do you have around you that you could reach out to? Like, well, how are you going to exercise? What's your sleep schedule like? Sort of reinforcing kind of our natural coping that we do when things are tough without having to be on medications necessarily.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because I think that sometimes we feel like this is a discrete event and forget to say, you know what, you learned some skills, go back to those skills and try that, but let's stay in touch. And if you need to be back on medications, terrific. But remember that you're going into this experience much better equipped than you were last time.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So, you know, you may forget calculus, but you hope you remember your skills for helping manage your mood.
Yeah, definitely.
I used to keep a calculus book on my shelf just so I could calculate interest rates and then, you know, compute.
So we, in our day treatment program, we have kids, right, who are doing high school, you know, calculus and advanced math. And seriously, like one of 10 of us can actually help with it because, no, I don't remember that, but I remember my coping skills.
So. Yeah, it was a hurdle we jumped, but this this sort of thing, the coping skills should be something we integrate into our life. Well, Christy, thank you so much for spending time with us. You've been so helpful, as you always are. And, you know, if I have a difficult patient, you not only would not mind if I called the call-up line, you would welcome the opportunity to collaborate in care. Am I right?
I would welcome the opportunity. I would probably do a little happy dance in my office. Like, seriously, we love getting calls. We love getting to talk about cases. There's, you know, it's a really fun position for us to be in as psychiatrists, to have this time that we can spend just, you know, helping primary care doctors.
But I think there's so much about medical education that makes us feel like I really ought to be able to manage this on my own. But I think this is an area where it is so profitable to collaborate with someone, because these are difficult problems. And we really, really appreciate you for doing this. And we appreciate the legislature for allocating the funds. And so if you have a legislator, please feel free to let them know that this is a really great boon to us as pediatricians, and most especially to the kids of Utah.
I agree. Yes. Well said.
Thanks for being with us. Hope you wouldn't mind coming back sometime.
I would be happy to.
All right. Thanks, Christy.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns.
None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.